Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Mike Gorrell. I am this morning's board representative from the church. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please read these announcements listed in the order of service. I was asked very politely by Ellen from the high school to pay particular attention to one of the announcements, which is a romantic Valentine's Day dinner that must be sponsored by the high schoolers. In addition to the announcements that are in the order of service, I'm asked to have our visitors please join me and several other people in the minister's office for coffee after the service. We'd like to chat, answer any questions you may have, and take the opportunity to get to know you. Our designated monthly collection. Today is the monthly designated collection sponsored by the Social Action Committee. It will be taken along with the regular weekly collection. This month's collection will go to the Waukesha County Dental Society, which provides access to low-cost dental care for disadvantaged county residents. We now have a special announcement about the retreat.
I hope you all know we're having an all-church retreat on February 4th, Saturday, and we have sign-up sheets. They'll be available in the social hall, and Anna's going to talk a little bit about it.
George O'Keefe said, "No one sees a flower, really. To see takes time, like to have a friend takes time." The retreat for me is a time set aside to be with a creative, kind, and interesting community of people that make up this congregation. And I've always felt them to be very valuable, so I hope you're there.
Thanks, and talk to any of us in the social hall. There's a couple of us that will be standing by a table, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have. It's a really great day, so we hope you can join us.
And I have an announcement by Gus, which I will read, and then I have a pronouncement from Gus afterwards, which he will come up here and read himself. If you are already signed up for an adult enrichment class this semester, or if you intend to sign up for one or more of the classes, please remember to register your name in the church office. There are registration forms and information regarding the donations requested for registration in the office. Thank you very much on behalf of the Adult Enrichment Committee.
Groucho Marx once famously said, "I refuse to join any club that would have me as a member." I felt the same way about religions, because I was convinced that if the religious folks in a church knew what I really thought about religion and how I behaved as a person, they wouldn't want me. On the other hand, I would refuse to join them before they would have a chance to reject me. But I was proven wrong. This church, specifically the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church, proved to me that not only did I have a mind like other members, so much the worse for them, but that my heart beat just as theirs did. And it was demonstrated to me in a very concrete way when my mother died. I have already stated here at the church in a previous Sunday service that I received about 90 emails from members, remarkable number, since the total membership for the church is somewhere only around 140 or 50. But it wasn't just the volume of the emails and the sympathy cards that I received that told me that I wasn't alone. It was the messages contained therein. There was no pious theological gibberish shared. I did not read any patronizing lectures about how I'll get over it or how time heals all wounds. Rather, folks shared their own personal experience, their own pain, their own confused feelings of grief and guilt. And in sharing these stories, they created a spiritual space, which is the same thing as a religion, where spirits connect and thoughts and feelings fuse into a common fabric, which, nonetheless, safeguards the threads of their own individual differences. In being for each other, we are goodness for each other. Our religion is the goodness of the other, with a capital O. Our religion rejoices in this plurality, which is shared precisely as the transcendence of otherness. Specifically, this congregation will grow as a result of the creative power of our sharing our differences, which calls for a commitment to each other which transcends what any one of us could do alone. It is to this personal bond that we say amen, hallelujah.
Thanks, Gus. I now invite you to greet those sitting around you. Greetings.
Greetings again.
Do you do the introduction of speaker?
If you have something, that is great, because, oh, awesome. Do you want me to read it? I will.
I mean, if you can use that.
No, this is probably... If you're visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available at the table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after for a while, but then, as I announced, I'll be in the minister's office if anybody would like to meet up. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the story for all ages, at which time they will go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along and observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's any need for child care during the service. Classes will end at 11:15 a.m., at which time you can pick your child up from their classes. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. In the conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring. Our speaker this morning is Philip Chard. Philip Chard is president and CEO of Empathia, Inc., a global EAP and behavioral services firm providing health, safety, and productivity solutions for over 300 companies representing over 2 million covered lives. He writes an award-winning weekly column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel titled Out of My Mind, and author of Healing Earth, which is the 1995 Midwest Publishers Award, Nature's Ways, which examines spiritual aspects of nature intersection, and Beast Management, which provides creative approaches to workplace conflict resolution. Philip is a contributing writer to Chicken Soup for the Women's Soul and has been a guest expert on ABC's television's 2020. He has also presented at the Brookings Institution. He holds a master's degree in counseling psychology and taught behavioral science at Michigan State University, where he received an outstanding faculty award.
When peace can tell someone you love them from the bottom of your heart, and believe that it's the truest thing you've known. And even if you never prayed, the promises you've made, the river's gonna keep on rolling on. And if you haven't got a dollar, not a penny to your name, somebody's gonna miss you when you're gone. And even if you never find just a little peace of mind, the river's gonna keep on rolling on. Keep on rolling to the ocean. Keep on rolling to the sea. Keep on rolling to the love we need, washes over you and me. Keep on rolling till the love we need washes over you and me. It is well with my soul. It is well. It is well with my soul.
Good morning. The soul is often hungrier than the body, and no shops can sell it food. This morning we will read our congregational response. And it's in your order of service. I think a lot of us know it. May love shine forth through us today. May light of reason guide our way. May joy and truth come. Affirm that burns in everyone. Our opening hymn is number 4, I Brought My Spirit to the Sea.
Thank you.
now it is time for the story for all ages. Any of you that would like to join me up here? Any large or small children? Thanks, you guys. I have a story called Jelly Beans. I'm going to have a hard time showing you the pictures while I read, but I'll do my best. Here's a rabbit with his cell phone. Hey, a message. Hi, have you seen how nice it is outside? How about going out to the park to eat jelly beans? Bye, Oscar. P.S. You bring the jelly beans. You can come closer. Okay, is his little kitty friend. Okay, see you later. Bye, George. P.S. You bring the drinks. Rats. He speeds, leaving his pursuers behind. He's outsmarted them once again. Oh, rats, rabbit has a flat tire. And the cat answers the phone. Hi, it's Oscar. What's keeping you? And the rabbit says, I'm almost there. I had a flat tire. Excuse me. I had a flat tire. They get together finally. What kind of jelly beans have you got? A bag of mixed ones. Oh boy, any blue ones in there? A few. What did you bring to drink? Hot chocolate. Great. I brought some sugar too. I want a cinnamon one. This one is as blue as the sky. Do you think... He's gazing into his cocoa cup. Up there, do you think there's a heaven up there? A place to go when you're dead? I don't know. I think so. Will we go there too? Both of us? Well, I'm going if you're going, that's for sure. We might bump into each other there. That would be nice. But what if it's really big and you never bump into anybody? Or so crowded that we never find each other? We can agree to meet at the entrance, see the inside? Or at one of the special meeting places. Wow, that was fast. That's a good idea. But maybe we won't know each other when we get there. What do you mean? Well, because maybe when we're dead, we'll have forgotten everything we ever did. Then there's no sense in meeting at the entrance. But if we bump into each other and we don't recognize each other, then we can just become friends all over again. Eat jelly beans together, stuff like that. See, they meet up in there. Will there be jelly beans there? Maybe not. Then I'll just have to bring some with me. Great, and I'll bring the hot chocolate. Great. That's the end of the story. Megan, will you come up? You're our chalice carrier today. Thank you. And now it is time for joys and concerns. Greeters will bring microphones to you. You can say your name and share your joy or your sorrow with us today. And since tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, I will light the first candle for all the progress that has been made in not only in race relations, but in uplifting of humanity and all the great distance we have yet to go.
There was a very sad wake the other night for a 26-year-old man, young man who's the son of Tracy Langan, a former member of our church, and he died of unknown causes. It was an unexpected death. It's so tragic to lose a son that age, and their hearts are very broken. So just send out your intentions of love and light.
I have a sorrow or a concern that's not as sad as the one just mentioned, but I always am so sad at Martin Luther King Day that the Lake Country area schools don't recognize it, and they don't have it off.
I'm Diane. I'd like you to light a candle of concern for my friend of, must be 60 years. He's in the final stages of dying, and doctors have stopped all treatment, but he keeps his constant good, I don't know what you'd call it. Anyway, he just, he hasn't given up hope. He's just happy. He's a happy person. He's lived a good life.
And I will light one. We have another one? Okay, sorry.
My aunt was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and so I am wishing her well through her journey.
And I will light one last candle for the joys and concerns that we hold in our hearts.
Good morning. I speak at a fair number of churches and congregations, and I want to thank you for not requiring that I wear a tie. It's one of the wonderful things about Unitarian Universalists, of many wonderful things. The meditation I wanted to share with you this morning, and we'll follow this with a brief moment of silent meditation, is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I'm going to say it twice, so it can kind of sink in a little bit. He wrote, "We see the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, the tree, but the whole, of which these are the shining parts, is the soul." Again, "We see the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, the tree, but the whole, of which these are the shining parts, is the soul."
And now we will rise as we are able and sing hymn 123, Spirit of Life.
couple of readings to share with you. The first is from Steve Jobs of Apple fame. I believe this is remarks he made at commencement speech at Stanford. Almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. And a second reading is from Emily Dickinson. Death is a dialogue between the spirit and the dust. Dissolve, says death, and the spirit replies, Sir, I have another trust. Death doubts it, argues from the ground. The spirit turns away, just laying off for evidence an overcoat of clay. Thank you. time ago, my daughter asked me, do we have a soul? And I said, ask yourself that question when you're listening to some beautiful music sometime. Thanks for being here and for opening yourself to these ideas. Roughly about 6,600 people will die in the United States today, every day, on average. That's about 2.4 million a year, barring major catastrophes. Just over half of the people who will expire in America today, or about 3,700, will succumb to heart disease or cancer, while accidents and stroke will claim many of the rest. However, somewhere between 80 and 90 will die by their own hands through what we antiseptically label suicide. The vast majority of those who end their lives are under age 45. Most are male. Women attempt suicide more than men, but succeed far less. As the Native Americans realized when they measured age by how many winters one has survived, the cold season is the time of dying in the United States. January regularly wins out as the month with the highest death rate, followed closely by March, April, and December. February would be second, but it has too few days to win the statistical race. Given the sheer magnitude and objectivity of such statistics, the passing of one soul would seem of little significance. This is the perspective afforded to those who have yet to stare into death's eyes, leaving it, in their minds, a murky and somewhat uninteresting abstraction. However, as all of us know who have felt death up close and personal, either directly or vicariously through someone we love, that significance is not derived from numbers on a spreadsheet, but from the heartfelt experience of loss, of time slipping through one's fingers, of dust scattered to the wind. What's more, it is not a collective soul, but an individual one that looks death in the eyes. In the same way that a part of us is always alone in some existential sense, we die alone. Still, it's important to acknowledge that death, while one of the most universal of experiences, individual experiences in life, has an undeniably universal quality. None of us will get out of here alive, as the right adage goes, so the reality of death, along with that of birth, is the common element to all members of our species. It shapes, or at least frames, virtually everything else of significance in one's life: religious beliefs, sense of purpose, meaning, attitude, choices, fears, the rest. Death has always been central in defining our beliefs about life. As former UN Ambassador Dag Hammarskjöld, I know I said that wrong, put it, quote, in the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all the important questions that life puts to us. So, death compels us to look for the answers to life's bigger questions. And most organized religions are ready and eager to offer us these answers, always using death as a backdrop to their admonitions. Ministers invoke death to admonish their congregants to cleave to the straight and narrow, seek God. Parents hold it over their youngsters, preaching caution as they edge out into the world's sometimes capricious mayhem. Health practitioners counsel us to forestall it with exercise, sound nutrition, clean living. Philosophers debate its nature and significance, often defining the brightness of existence in contrast to death's opaque and often ominous background. Gurus and shamans insist that life is but a dream, and death is a portal through which we must pass to awaken to a far greater truth. Young and hungry minds struggle to intellectually peel away the mystery of mortality, even though most have yet to feel it in the marrow of their souls. But when you sense death close at your side, when it sits with you as you hold vigil over a dying loved one, or directly witness another's demise, the whole affair rapidly transitions from a philosophical there and then to a much more practical here and now. Soldiers in combat, victims of disasters, first responders, nurses, physicians, other caregivers, these and others who walk with or closely behind the grim reaper can no longer regain the comfortable disassociation and denial that shields so many from life's shadowy companion until they have no choice. It is through this cold proximity that one discovers deeply what one really believes about life, death, and what, if anything, may follow it. When one witnesses or confronts death intimately, idle curiosities and sanctimonious certainties fall away like so much cognitive debris, and one is left with the core of one's essential beliefs. So, what do you believe about the nature of death and whether something that constitutes you survives beyond its doorway? And is your belief, whatever it may be, is it based on an intellectual or philosophical exploration? Or does it arise from some visceral experience you have had that touched you deeply? Think about it. Each of us harbors an opinion on this subject, even if that view can be encapsulated in the phrase, "I haven't a clue." Or as Woody Allen put it, "I don't believe in an afterlife, but I am bringing a change of underwear." Fainted. Okay. Yeah, given the subject, it was a little scary. Where was I? Woody Allen, right? Okay. A little comic relief? Okay. Personally, I'm not bringing a change of underwear, but... Okay, back to the question of how you arrived at your opinion or your belief about death. And how exactly did you arrive at that? Have life experiences been the sculpture of your beliefs? Among the younger folks in attendance, are you working off what your parents or your peers have told you on the subject? Or have you given this some thought on your own, or is it a little too soon for that? This is not to suggest that an intimate association with death or the absence of such invariably leads one to a set of beliefs in this regard to the exclusion of others. One person, previously full of doubt or skepticism, may brush against death's door and emerge with a deep and abiding faith in a supreme being, the immortal soul, and an afterlife. Another, once certain of such things, may suddenly find their prior tenets mere conjecture or simply empty reassurances without solidity. One woman told me when I worked on an oncology unit in a hospital as providing a support group, "They lied to me," she said, just having watched her mother slip away. "How so?" I asked. And she replied, "They told me that God was with her, that she was going to be to a better place, that her spirit would be at peace." "I don't believe any of that," she said. "I saw what death is, and there's nothing there but a cold and heartless end," she insisted. For her, what she perceived as lies about death had been lifelong, starting with her religious education as a child and persisting until the final days of her mother's existence. "Oblivion," she whispered through her tears, certain now that death is the end of all. Not long after that experience, on the same oncology unit, another woman in similar circumstances, but with her father, confided that she had found a new faith in peace beside his deathbed. She told me, "What I felt is beyond words." In her father's final moments, she found herself wrapped in a warm and loving certainty that had eluded her for decades. For the first time, she understood what people meant when they used the word faith. And for others, the ambiguities and paradoxes persist. An intimate familiarity with death sometimes fails to bring clarity of any kind. But it does convey one kind of certainty, that death is among the most hard and irrefutable of realities, although there is one reality that is perhaps harder still: to die without having fully lived. As the philosophers remind us, death is more universal than life. Everyone dies, but not everyone lives. Nonetheless, once death has become a reality in one's life, whatever one's conclusions or confusions about it, there's no turning back, no retreat into intellectualism. From the time we become conscious of death and its very personal relationship to each of us, it remains our companion. One poet described it as a shadow that walks just a bit behind each of us, waiting for that time to step forward and place a cold and indifferent hand on one's spiritual shoulder. And so we're left to ponder that most fundamental of human inquiries: when I die, does some aspect of my identity, often called the soul, survive my body's demise and move on to an unseen realm and purpose? Or is it simply lights out, game over, thanks for the ride? Nobody knows, but surveys show that about 90% of us do believe in the soul. Still, the convictions of the majority should not be mistaken for proof. So, recently, neuroscientists have begun weighing in on the subject of the soul and immortality. In this regard, they have studied the opaque worlds of near-death experiences, NDEs we call them, out-of-body experiences, OOBs, we've got acronyms for everything, and mystical states that replicate both of these. A Gallup survey shows that 10 million Americans have reported either a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience, or something consistent with them, which usually involves experiencing an intense white light, being in a tunnel, a serene kind of calm, and a feeling that one is out of one's body. 10 million people. Not long ago, neuroscientists identified a site in the brain they believe is the source of near-death experiences. And when they stimulated this area in a number of studies of subjects who then reported sensations and mental imagery similar to that described by those reporting NDEs, near-death experiences, they arrived at this conclusion: there is no afterlife. Near-death experiences are simply hallucinations from a hypoxic or oxygen-starved brain as it dies. To them, it is nature's last act of compassion, just a way to buffer one's psyche from its final oblivion. However, patients suffering from brain hypoxia, which happens at death, but who do not experience clinical death, do not also experience serenity, a loving white light, out-of-body sensations, and so on. Instead, they experience confusion and agitation. So if it's the same experience happening in the brain, why are these people having different experiences? Well, to reconcile this conflict, scientists conducted what are called EEG studies, studies of the electrical activity in the brain, on patients as they actually died. These people were either terminally ill or severely brain damaged and were being removed from life support. Most of them died peacefully, and as expected, as their brains were deprived of blood and oxygen, brain activity, as measured by this EEG test, ebbed away. But then, in every patient they studied, when everything seemed shut down, there was an abrupt burst of brain activity lasting a minute or two. And the EEG showed that this brain activity correlated with that seen during conscious awareness, although these people remained unconscious. Then, just as abruptly, this burst of brain activity ceased. The explanation? Well, they don't really have one. But one that has been offered for this phenomenon, as well as near-death experiences, based on an area of scientific study called quantum biology. Now, you're going to have to hang with me for these next couple of pages. Now, quantum physics, for any of you who are familiar with it, and those who are not, deals with the incredibly small. in the quantum world, an atom, which we obviously can't even see with the naked eye, is huge. So quantum biology addresses how our bodies and brains work at the most incredibly small level, the smallest. Now, there's no scientific proof that consciousness arises from the neurochemical and neuroelectrical processes found in the brain. Most of you sitting out there are of the opinion that brain, consciousness, one and the same. But neuroscientists can't prove where consciousness comes from, how it occurs, and what activities in the brain are specifically the source of it, if any. In fact, neuroscience has no cogent explanation for how consciousness emerges from the brain at all, or even if consciousness requires a brain in order to exist. They assume it does, but they can't prove it. Now, quantum biology offers a theory that might solve this conundrum, one suggesting that consciousness is composed of sequences of what are called quantum computations inside of the neurons in our brains, or potentially any cell in the body for that matter. The idea is that consciousness is a property of the quantum world, the very, very tiny, itself, meaning everything we can detect inside and out of ourselves. And the brain, as an organic structure, organizes itself around a particular kind of consciousness, the human kind. Pretty heady stuff, but there's more. In the quantum world, there are processes and events that, from the perspective of a human scale of experience, are basically magical. I'll describe one that Einstein called, quote, spooky action at a distance. Other physicists call this quantum entanglement. Let me try to give it to you as simply as I can. They took two of these little tiny particles called quarks. Quarks are things that you can put in a stupendous number of in one little tiny atom. That's how small they are. They took two of them that were related, connected to each other, if you will. They were bonded, these two particles. And then they took one particle and they shot it off and away from the first one, far, far away. Well, these two particles are bonded electrically. One of them is a positive charge, one's a negative charge. You scientists out there know how that works and how they attract and then repel. So they attract. One particle goes away, the negative particle, let's say, goes off in the distance, and they put it through an electromagnetic field that switches its electrical charge from negative to positive. The instant that they do that, the particle that was left behind switches its polarity too. They can't measure anything that constitutes communication between these two particles, and it happens instantaneously, meaning there is no delay. How does this particle over here and this particle over here stay connected even though they are many, many miles apart in many of these experiments? That's quantum entanglement. They're connected, they're related, even though they're apart, something is communicating back and forth between them and we can't measure what it is. Then there's another phenomenon called quantum superposition, which basically means that quantum particles can exist in multiple locations at the same time. Am I starting to burn out some synapses yet? It reminds me of that old fire sign theater saying, how can you be in two places at once when you're not anywhere at all? But basically, what they're saying is the quantum world is probably what consciousness is all about. And that quantum world doesn't behave like the world that we operate up here at this level of reality. It's very different, it's magical, it's spooky, as Einstein called it, and does really bizarre things. So let's look at what those mean about the soul, consciousness, and death. These quantum processes I just described to you are not hypothetical. They've been proven repeatedly in scientific studies over and over. They happen, they're real. So if consciousness is a quantum event, rather than a neurological one, meaning tied to the brain and the brain only, there is reason to believe that it does not cease to exist when the brain dies. Of course, science is one way of knowing, but not the only way. Among those who assert that we have an immortal soul, we find great diversity and variation. Between the widely held view of Christians that one's soul earns its way into heaven, where it spends eternity in the presence of God, and the Hindu idea that souls are sculpted across eons through multiple incarnations, there's plenty of room for conjecture. However, most religions express views about the soul and its existence after death, and in some fashion or another, most of these assert, as Aristotle did, that, quote, we must no more ask whether the soul and body are one than ask whether the wax and the figure impressed upon it are one. As this statement in most theologies maintain, there is an invisible something, not unlike the wind or the undetectable force behind quantum entanglement, spooky action at a distance, that innervates and sustains a human being at a level we can only detect by its effects. There are no instruments that can find and directly measure what we call a soul. But how do we come to believe that we have one anyway? Well, some neuroscientists maintain that the brain is hardwired for mystical experiences, the kind that convince people that an unseen but powerfully spiritual world exists out there. Why would our brains be hardwired for that? Psychologists suggest that believing in an immortal soul is simply self-serving, wishful thinking, a way to fend off the fear of death and oblivion, which is what we have to do if we're going to keep working our way through life. On the flip side, the spiritually inclined assert that earlier humans merely awoke, albeit gradually and sometimes in strange ways, to the presence of their souls. Over time, some of these ancient ones demonstrated an inclination toward mystical states and visions. Later, they became shamans, gurus, priests. It's interesting that today, when we want to have ministers, we send them to school to learn theology and all that sort of thing, but in the olden times you had to kind of earn it by being weird. They would return from these altered states that they experienced and interpret for others the meanings of these experiences. Some told their fellow tribesmen that death is not the conclusion of life, but only a transition from one realm to another. From that core concept, a plethora of beliefs emerged, resulting in today's diversity of religions, not to mention personal theologies. Now, psychology's weighed in on this debate, too. Psychoanalyst Carl Jung took Freud's concept of the ego and expanded it to include a kind of mental trinity, which he called the ego, or small self — that's the one you call me, I — the individual unconscious, what some refer to as the subconscious mind, and the collective unconscious, which some mystical traditions refer to as the Atman, the whole, the void, the ground of being, the unity that connects all. This view posits the idea that the ego, a socially contrived persona or identity created through the interplay between my experiences with the world and my basic temperament, is what perishes at death. In other words, what I call me, or what you refer to as Philip Chard, does disappear at death because this social identity is a function of the brain alone. It's made up. Or, as philosopher Bertrand Russell put it, to expect a personality to survive the disintegration of the brain is like expecting a cricket club to survive when all its members are dead. It does have a certain Bertrand Russell ring to it, doesn't it? Did you ever see a picture of that guy? Anyway, however, this theory goes that implicit essence which enervates my existence, the life force or the ground of being or whatever you want to call it, is eternal and simply moves on to find expression in some other creative or living process out there in the universe. In other words, interpose your name with mine, Philip Chard, the ego, the social identity, dies. But the force that is now being manifested through me, in all of you, lives on. Or as poet Edward Young put it, life is the desert, the solitude. Death joins us to the great majority, meaning the collective unconscious in Jung's thinking. Now, many other versions of reality attempt to explain the mystery of death in our sense that we are more than biological machines. Some propose that, as the old ditty intones, life is but a dream, and that death is when we awaken. Or, as the Chinese proverb states, Life is a dream walking. Death is a going home. Others point to paranormal phenomena such as ESP, clairvoyance, and even poltergeists, it's a fancy word for ghosts, as evidence that an entire spiritual realm resides just beyond the reach of our perceptions and our technology. So, where does all this conjecture go to? From the neuroscientists who say there's no soul, to the quantum biologists who say maybe there is, we got an explanation for that, to the philosophers and the theologians and the psychologists, they've all got their point of view. Where does this all leave us? I recall a conversation with my daughter when she was first struggling with these questions, as most of us do. She proposed most of the theories I've skimmed over today, with the exception of quantum biology, and then lamented the uncertainty and confusion that such an abundance of theories provokes, and understood why some people then go run and hide in one particular belief, because it's just too much to keep thinking about all this stuff. Finally, after we talked it over quite a bit, she turned to me and asked, "What do you believe, Dad?" My answer was, "I believe in the mystery. Fundamentally, that is what we are left holding, a bona fide mystery. And lest you consider such a conclusion an act of intellectual laziness on my part, I ask that we all remember that science has done as much or more to support this conclusion than religion. For example, it is science that tells us that roughly 85% of the stuff in our universe is as yet beyond the detection of our senses or our instruments. They refer to this as dark matter and dark energy. We can tell it's there, but we can't directly detect it. Kind of like the wind. You can see its effects, but you can't see it. We can infer that this so-called dark matter, dark energy that makes up most of the universe and that we can't directly detect, exists by measuring its effects on other things and processes. Remembering again Aristotle's statement, we must no more ask whether the soul and body are one than ask whether the wax and the figure impressed on it are one. We can see the impression, but we don't know what's making it. I'd call that a mystery. And because most of our environment is, in fact, undetectable, it seems fair to conclude that there may be much more going on around, within, and between us than we can possibly imagine. Of course, the fundamental instrument that we use to ponder such oddities is consciousness itself, the capacity to be aware and, in the human case, to be aware that one is aware. This is something that you run into in psychotherapy all the time. The definition of neurosis, which, by the way, they've dropped out of the diagnostic and statistical manual. You can't be neurotic anymore. Sorry. I always kind of enjoyed it, so I was disappointed to see this, but the definition of neurosis is, if you're depressed, you're depressed. Okay, you're depressed. But if you're neurotic, you're depressed about being depressed. Okay. Here's where we turn to another mind-bending paradox, the last one I'll lay on you this morning. While most of us assume that the lion's share of what we think, feel, decide, analyze, and experience occurs within our conscious awareness, which I hope you all are exercising right now, neuroscience has demonstrated convincingly that this is not the case at all. The so-called subconscious mind, or what neuroscientists refer to as the adaptive unconscious, is responsible for the vast majority of processes in the central nervous system. The average human brain has about 100 billion neurons that collectively can hold around 250 quintillion bits of information. Try to get that on your hard drive sometime. Exponentially more than you can cram into any computer on Earth. What's more, the average brain is capable of a processing speed of roughly 20 million billion calculations per second. Your brain can do 20 million billion calculations per second. Can you imagine what you'd be like if you were consciously aware of all of that happening all the time? You'd be nuts. So here's the problem. Short-term memory, which is where we mostly operate when we say we are conscious of something, is restricted to about 7 bits of information at any given moment in time. A phone number. Okay? So essentially, the vast majority of your brain activity, including some sophisticated processes such as decision-making, forming beliefs and opinions, interpreting experiences, assigning meaning to events, etc., takes place outside of your conscious awareness. What does that mean? It means there's an awful lot going on that we don't know or understand, both outside of us in the universe that we mostly can't detect, and inside of us that we mostly don't know is happening as it is. So, finally, recent research suggests that, as is true with intelligence, there are many different forms of consciousness, and the brain does not appear to be the origin of them all. In fact, there is growing scientific evidence suggesting that consciousness occurs in a variety of human organs, including the heart, and may even be a diffuse phenomena rather than one that is located in one specific organ or area of the body. So this whole emphasis on the brain, and the brain is the source of the illusion of the soul, and when the brain dies, is being undermined by science itself. So, neuroscience still cannot pinpoint exactly what consciousness is or where it originates. And while some assert that human awareness is entirely a function of the brain, and therefore the soul, it is equally plausible that the brain is not the origin of consciousness at all, but rather an organ that manifests and expresses certain kinds of consciousness that operate independently of it, much as a radio receives an audio signal derived from another source entirely. Perhaps in this instance, the source or signal that the brain picks up is from the so-called quantum world, which physicists, not theologians, describe as a sea of energy that gives rise to everything in the universe, including us. So the brain may be more like a radio than a transmitter. Given how little we truly know and understand about our spiritual nature and the larger mystery in which we participate, perhaps it is best that I close this very heady talk by letting poet Emily Dickinson again have the last word when she wrote, as I intoned before, "Death is a dialogue between the spirit and the dust." And perhaps the spirit and the dust are two very different expressions of the same unbroken and deeply spiritual reality. As the great spiritual teacher Vivekananda told us, each soul is a star, and all stars are set in the infinite azure, the eternal sky, the Lord. Thank you for listening to all that. If it was as hard for you to listen to as it was for me to write, you have my sympathies. And is it now that we'll do the polylog?
Do we have some?
Any comments? Questions? Are we going to do the microphone thing? Okay. Just have your hand up and they'll bring a mic to you.
Hi, I'm Fran.
Hi.
And I want to, first of all, thank you so much for another stunning presentation for all of us. Like everyone, I've been thinking about this, especially after this point in my life, losing a mother, losing a younger brother. When I'm out in nature, that force, and you use the word force, I do feel a connection. And then just thinking about matter is not created or destroyed. We just go on in another form. The molecules that are me were once on the tail of a comet, you know, in the hoof of a dinosaur, that kind of thing. There was something wonderful for those of you that key into TED. I was just watching this weekend where a biologist, in order to present what goes on at that most basic DNA level, digitized into sort of a colored cartoon, whatever, made as visual as possible by magnifying a billion times what goes on when DNA replicates, etc. And it's just incredible. And it's as though there is this other molecular consciousness that creates this recreation that's going on constantly within the body. And somehow, when I get really fried at the thought of death, I think about all the other ways in which the particles that are me, which is a real reality, are going to go on in some sort of another level of... And listening to you, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's just some other level of consciousness, a different kind of consciousness. And it's comforting. Thank you.
Thank you. And just as a side note to that, you of course know that everything in this room, including us, was born in the furnaces of giant red-hot stars billions of years ago. So we are all connected that way. We all came from stardust. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm going to go next. This is Carrie. I'm over here. I just wanted to let you all know that Jesse, you probably noticed that Jesse passed out over here. She was leaving, and she's fine. She just was dehydrated, and she needed a little food in her tummy, and she's fine. So I just wanted to let you all know that.
Thanks for letting us know that. We'll press for time, so maybe one or two more.
I'll be quick.
Please.
This is Janica. I so enjoyed what you were saying. It explains a lot to me intuitively. In particular, it made me think back to being there when my mom passed and my dad passed. And in my dad's case, it was minutes after. But the difference between the two of them that I saw was that in my mom's case, after she was gone, it was one of those kinds of things where her body, she didn't look like her anymore. My dad, not so much, but what was left of my mom's corporal self did not look like her. Mm. And I've been thinking about that for since she passed away, and I just figured there had to be you get a curious thought, you'll figure it out later, and I'm not sure exactly how, but what you just said helped me figure that out.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My name is Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And I appreciated almost everything you talked about.
Almost.
I had some problems with quantum biology.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, there's a scale issue here, and that is that quantum entanglement is taking place on a scale that is many orders of magnitude smaller than an electron.
Definitely.
An electron is where the electrical charge is carried. And then an electron is taking place on a scale many orders of magnitude smaller than a brain cell or any other biological kind of.
Correct.
So I didn't really follow the connection you made from the one scale to the other.
I don't blame you. However, if you do read up on quantum biology, you'll find some very interesting information about how quantum effects occur inside of, they're actually called tubules inside the neurons of the brain. And you're right about the fact that they're well below in orders of magnitude anything at the electron level or the molecular level. Of course, atoms are mostly empty space, as we know. But I think if you look into that, you'll see that they do a much better job of explaining it than I did. But thanks for your question.
Hi, Bruce over here.
Bruce.
Yeah, I studied some quantum biology. First of all, I want to thank you for an excellent presentation.
You're welcome.
Very enlightening, actually hopeful, hopeful about the existence of the collective conscious and possibly, that may be something related to the soul.
Mm-hmm.
The microtubules, I read this study about the microtubules and how they're affected, they have quantum effects, and they think that may be the way that we're connected to the quantum field.
Right.
Very interesting. I guess the only thing in the short time I'd want to say is when I lecture to my students in, neuroscience, I always tell them that their brains have so many connections that the number of connections in their brain, the possible connections, exceed the total number of particles in the universe. So they have no excuse for failing any of the exams that I do.
That's great. I love that. Okay, I think we probably for time one more.
Okay, I'm Terry, and I just wanted to say I don't understand anything about
quantum anything,
yeah.
except when you were talking, it reminded me of when elephants are friends and know each other when they're young, mm-hmm. and then they're separated maybe for years and years and years. I've seen this on, you know, on Discovery or National Geographic.
Sure.
And then for some reason they end up in the same refuge, and they immediately know each other, even though they've been separated maybe for 10 or 15 years, and they go right to each other. Sort of like you were talking about the particles changing, and what how would they know each other from so long ago if there wasn't some kind of connection?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, a number of the comments that you've given, and thank you for those, all point to the same kind of basic thing, and that is that there is, despite the tremendous advances that we've made both scientifically and in terms of our spiritual development and evolution as a species, what we know is minute compared to what we don't know. And so to close the book on any of these questions, I think, is premature. And one of the wonderful things about Unitarian Universalists is that mostly they don't close the book, and they keep wondering, looking, searching, and in this realm, that's clearly what you have to do. Thank you.
Today, our monthly designation goes to the Waukesha Community Dental Clinic. Loose cash will be attributed to. Otherwise, you can make a check to LCUUC with a memo saying the dental clinic. Our congregational affirmation is number 732 in your big books for Martin Luther King Jr. Great Spirit of light and of darkness, we gather once again to remember a fallen friend and nourish ourselves from the fountain of reflections. Open our hearts to the anguish of our pain, to the tired taste of swallowed tears, and to our unrealized vision.
In this place we bring together as God's growing for meaning and beginning truth.
Be with us as we continue our search for understanding of the mystery of the temporal. Move with us as we unravel the implied imperatives of hopes unfulfilled. As we touch one another in common cause and with the great spirit in our midst,
let us find the way and the river to show this in us.
Amen. And we will close with hymn number 347, Gather the Spirit.
Benediction from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Tell me not in mournful numbers life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul.